Hello and welcome to Finally Friday. This chat session is run by EXARC, the Society for Archaeological Open Air Museums, Experimental Archaeology, Ancient Technology and Interpretation. My name is Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am joined by two EXARC members who focus on public outreach, prehistoric technologies and specialist knowledge in experimental archaeology. Ian Dennis is a field archaeologist, archaeological illustrator and experimental archaeologist based at Cardiff University in Wales. His research focuses on the use of experimental archaeology to explore craft manufacturing techniques from the Mesolithic, Neolithic, Bronze Age, and Norse Britain. This research is based in multiple technologies, from flint to ceramics, but is currently focusing on antler combs. Ian also demonstrates prehistoric technologies at public events and festivals. Teresa Camper is a materials analyst and experimental archaeologist specializing in leather and tanning technologies in a range of time periods. Her research focuses on the microscopic analysis of tanning technologies and skin morphology, as well as producing accurate replicas of archaeological leather artifacts. Teresa also provides a variety of different workshops for the public, as well as demonstrations at museums around the world. So welcome to both of you, Ian and Teresa. I do have one question to start you off with. So Ian, you have a relatively wide range of experience in terms of the technologies you investigate, so flint, antler, bone, ceramics. Teresa, you're very specialized in one particular technology, that of leatherworking. So for both of you, what do you think are the pros and the cons of these different approaches? So having a broader range of technologies versus specialization in one technology.
Personally, I guess I feel like the ability to focus all of my energy and time on studying one subject in a very in-depth way gives me time to chase down all of the little details on the subject that perhaps if I had a wider focus, I might not have time to do. However, I have to be really careful, I feel, to take a step back once in a while and just make sure you're not missing the forest for the trees, so to speak. You want to really keep your subject firmly contextualized. Just one activity amongst many that were being done as part of daily life at the time periods that we're looking at. Then one other con that I think you get very specialized in one specific thing is really specialist use of terminology. And if you're talking to another leather specialist, you're going to use a whole suite of words that perhaps are not going to be the most effective way to communicate with a more general audience. When you're in these open air museum settings and you're speaking with the general public, you have to be really aware of that, that you're not just throwing out words that make no sense to anything but you. What do you think, Ian?
Kind of like what you do, but I take view that I like to be like a jack of all trades. It was something that my granddad said to me when I was younger, and it's how I've learned all my various skills across what I do, whether it be bone working, ceramics, carving, metalworking, and stuff like that. Yeah. So, unlike not similar to what you do, I like to focus on lots of various skills, materials, and uses within archaeology and craftwork. You can focus on each one. If you're, excuse the phrase, you're a little OCD like myself, you get drawn into the nitty gritty of what you do anyway. So it's like attention deficit I get sometimes. You can concentrate really hard on it for a long period, then you want to move on and do something else and something else. And then you do these aspects of what you're looking at within depth, yeah? But then you come back again to something that you started, say for the combs or the bone working or the flint knapping. I'll come back, revisit, and then go through it all again. I think it's just something that you do, and it's building up those skill sets gives you a little bit. I like the versatility of what I can do and how I can input into various aspects within, you know, archaeology, experimental archaeology, experiential, you name it, you can put into it. Yeah, so I do sort of agree a lot with Fraser, and I do agree about the terminology. Archaeology is very good at that, and it does alienate people outside if you sit there and use your terminology and special words for everything. And I think that's very important. And I'm glad you brought that up, because doing outreach and what we do with engaging with the public is you start to use very specialized words, they start to feel patronized. And you pick up on that very quickly. So you do have to slip into layman's terms, as we call it.
Yeah, absolutely. The ability to just communicate in such a way that everybody in the audience is drawn into the discussion and feels like they really understand what you're talking about. You can use specialty words, but just stop and explain what they mean. No one is going to feel like you're treating them like they're stupid if you explain a specialist word. Toss it out there and then kind of gloss right over it. You lose people's attention very quickly.
I agree on that one, most definitely. Reading people is part of our game with open air museums and reenactors and anyone who engages with that. you do tend to read your audience and you meet groups of people, families, or people that you want to chat to. And the more experience you get, you can quickly turn into how they want you to talk to them and stuff like that. And it then becomes a very friendly, open, funny chat most of the time. It's great fun.
Absolutely. One of the best parts, I think, about doing these demonstrations and talks in these museum settings, they're very informal. It's not like getting up on a podium and giving a presentation at a conference. You really do have one-on-one interaction with a lot of the people in the group. And for conveying information, that's possibly more effective.
Being informal and keeping it friendly is key. You know, you don't want to sit yourself up on the pedestal or give something like you do at a conference. It's not that highbrow in a sense. You try and convey information and enjoy wherever you're at. All these festivals or whatever you're at in the open days, they're all fun. Getting with the fun, isn't it? It's like, you know, so once they see that you're enthusiastic, they'll feed off your enthusiasm. That's also something that I've also noted. That's quite fun.
Absolutely. I completely agree. You get back the energy you put out.
So you mentioned the fact that you do these sort of more informal settings as well as the formal sort of academic conferences. So you both combine academic research with more kind of practical experience. How does this combination of viewpoints, sort of the very almost scientific academic research side of things versus the more informal kind of practical experience of the technology, how does this help you in your research? Do you view one as more important or one as more necessary?
Not sure that one is more important than the other. And I think putting them in some sort of hierarchy like that is actually fairly detrimental to our overall goal, saying that they work in synergy. You need both. I would absolutely say that my real world experience, my practical experience with my specialty area, that experience allows me to ask more targeted questions, as I can discount things I know from my personal experience don't work or don't work very well, and focus instead on the things which do. Those things that work well are the things that were more likely to have been used by early peoples. They spent most of their lives producing and using these technologies. And in some climates, when it comes to fur and leather, is, you know, really being good at this, the difference between life and death. So really feel like the real world, the practical experience feeds into your academic research. And the academic research then generates information that feeds back into communities of craft practice that work with these sorts of technology. And sometimes it's very difficult for these communities to get information on the latest finds, archaeological finds, because it's tied up in journals that they simply don't have access to.
You do need to be on a balance with input for academia and for what you do with your practical skills. Having the practical skills, especially when you're doing sort of experimental archaeology, and working with artifacts and writing reports on artifacts like a flint report or an antler report, etc., which I do, having the skill sets of understanding how they're made, done the experiments and worked out the sequences of construction or materials used, etc., is key to what you do. A lot of academia or reports and papers before on artifacts, as we were discussing, is sometimes lacking how it's made. It just assumes that you know it, and it assumes that that is the way without any other investigation. Times have moved on massively now, and I find that, you know, understanding your material, doing the experimental, doing the experiential, that's massively to your academic input and the research that you can do, and also involve others with it as well.
Absolutely, could not agree more.
Would you say then that it is always necessary to have technological specialists involved in experimental archaeology, and do you think that this is done enough in current experimental research?
Ooh, there's a tricky question. I would say personally that sort of depends on the experiment. However, ones that have a serious focus on technology, if you don't have someone who is very good at reproducing and using, those are separate things, and it often gets a little bit lost in the shuffle that you do also need to be able to use the tool effectively as well as produce it accurately. And if you don't have someone who has those skill sets, don't think your experiment is probably as robust as it could be. How do you feel about that?
I agree completely. You do need the specialists, and engaging with the specialists will be key. As you say, sometimes you've got a certain level of skills that you can do with your experiment. If you do have a specialist on hand, or you know, or you can bring in, you can discuss your ideas what you think it is and how to use certain tools, et cetera, as we've discussed, which are very important. And they may be able to put you on the right line, show you, or even do some of the work for you, and you can accredit them. So you're involving them within the research, and not only will they have the input of showing you what to do, they know that they'll be published in your work and what you'll earn and for further outputs as well. Yeah. So no, I do agree on that outside as well. Yeah. So they are essential, I think. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's essential in the sense that, you know, early peoples were using these things on a daily basis. They were really competent. If you really want an experiment that reflects that level of competence that you would have been seeing in these past time periods, then getting craft specialists on board is incredibly important. And I love that you made the point about crediting them. They're involved in the research. They should get that recognition that with a little bit of publicity for them in the long run. For a lot of people, these craftspeople actually make a living doing what they do, and a little bit of notoriety, a paper doesn't hurt anybody at all, and it's fair.
And I think this applies well with reenactors and reenacting societies as well, who I think we haven't used as much. I think Europe's far more ahead of Britain with the use of reenactors and how they're involved, and they're a much larger community as well. But Britain's beginning to move on quite quick, and it's very popular now. I found in the early stages, you know, 10, 12 years ago, to engage with reenactors, to look at what they're using and what they're making. And yeah, there's some very skilled people out there that do, you know, and they're completely dedicated to what they do, using them and involving them and even offering them access to come and look in the university at some of the real artifacts that they never get a chance to look at, that they can take scale photos and they can hold the objects, you know, gives them a much better input to their subject that they want to live and show to the public.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, it's just that cyclical setup, that symbiotic relationship between academia and these communities of craft practice. It's only fair that they get something for what they give back. If they're giving us their hard-earned knowledge and information, wonderful to be able to find ways to, in essence, repay that.
Agreed.
So related to this, both of you are quite technologically specialized, even though obviously, Ian, you're in a broad range, but you still know how to do woodworking, comb working, for antler working. And Therese, obviously, you are extremely adept at tanning yourself. You run workshops, you teach people how to do it. How experienced were you in your technological focus before you started academic research? Do you think that it's possible for people to not be specialized in a technology, but just work with a technologist, if that makes sense? Or do you think it's important to have that experience yourself?
I think you do need some experience with the tools and the material that you want to be work on or do research on or do experiments with. It's the experiential side that will give you that experience that allows you then to take it forward to do some experimental work. I think this is important. Once you've got to a certain level and a good grounding in the tool usage of the subject or the craft that you're looking at, having a specialist alongside you or working with somebody who knows it will only help you. Of course, it's just admitting that you're not as good as what you think you are in a short term. Yeah. So there's always somebody better than you out there, and just accept it. So if you can find these people and feed off and learn and use them and enhance your skills, which helps your experiment with involvement, I think that's key. Hey, I know it's a bit sharp and it's the point, but how do you agree, Therese?
I do, absolutely. Yes. I think that you as the researcher getting some level of experience will mean that then have a much more productive discussion with that expert that you do bring on board or that specialist. So that in and of itself helps. And then secondarily, you have some experience with the tools or the technology that you're wanting to do an experiment on. It will give you a better understanding of the variables that you're going to run into. And I think that can really help you focus your hypothesis, the question you're actually trying to ask, as well as design your methodology with sort of that scientific level of experimentation. That's really important that your methodology is really dialed in, and having a good understanding of the potential variables and problems that you're going to run into in the course of the experiment really do help with that. And Matilda, you did ask about what level of experience we had before we came into academia, and I think we both came in with a certain level of experience. For myself, I started tanning when I was 11, actually. I was not successful until I was 13. My parents did put up with a lot of interesting experiential archaeology, as we'll put it, in the backyard. And then I consistently tanned skins all the way until I came back to university when I was 29. I did have a very solid basis in my specialty field already. However, the academic pursuit of it really opened up a lot of avenues within it that I had not tried. I had no experience in alum tanning. I had to learn that in order to do the PhD. I had done some vegetable tanning, but it wasn't my main focus. I ended up learning a number of different variations of the fat tans that I had never experimented or experienced before. So it did push me to refine my craft and expand it all at the same time. I'm sure, Ian, you found some of those same sorts of issues while you made your way through the academic sphere.
Yes, like you, started young. It was to do with the family. It was my granddad, my uncle, toolmaker, woodworker, carpenter, carver. So I was taught very young how to use tools, various tools on various materials. In an everyday life situation, I suppose, going the way through, you know, I was shown how to hunt and shoot and bits and pieces, but it was all just part of everyday life to me. And moving on as you get older, obviously, you know, I mean, I was into sort of building and restoring motorcycles and Land Rovers. So you get that hands-on with technology, mechanics and everything. And using those skills within academia, as like you said, I can now apply. It was like when I first came to university and you go through it and you're doing your postgraduate stuff, etc., and you're moving on. All of a sudden, all these skill sets and things that you've learned when we were younger, I can now start to apply on stuff that I didn't even know existed. All of a sudden, it was like, wow, I found a discipline now that I can really put what I've learned from the past and gained to the test. You know, as you say, you do find areas where it's like, I've got a shortfall there. So I don't know about you, but I would go out, read about it, find people that have done it and just try it. And one of the things I always say, you can't do everything perfect to start with. You've got to break things, cut yourself with flint. It's got to go wrong for you to advance and increase your knowledge of what you're doing and what you're about.
I completely agree with that, completely. Anything that I ran into as I went through that I thought, oh, I've never heard of grain on fat tan. I've been doing this for years. I've never run into this, but archaeologically it exists. Someone was doing it. So then you go about saying, all right, well, let's figure out how that was done. And then usually I start looking, you know, you start hunting ethnographically. Does anybody else do this already? You don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel. And sort of that line of research opens up one more thing. You're finding things that are, you know, skin that's barely vegetable tanned, but technically it is vegetable tanned, even though the inside isn't all the way done. And it's done in some northern climates around the world. And you go from there and find things that are technically a fat tan, but actually they've never been worked soft. So they've got the oxidation, but they don't have the same fiber structure. And then you're sitting around trying to figure out, okay, how do you produce that? It's just, it's a never ending process. And it really does push you forward and forward.
Knowing your materials is understanding them and trying to think a way around things. I mean, I've got an example like you had when I've been working antler, and obviously I look at all aspects, not just the combs that you can make from them and stuff, but it's the bracelets I've come across from the 4th, 5th, right through to the 7th century AD. And I was just in my office on a Friday afternoon. I've been reading McGregor of how these are done, and they say nobody's actually attained it or done it or reached it, yeah? Or how to make these bangles, or if you want, wristbands out of antler. I was just sitting there, it was a Friday afternoon, and I just got, well, I got a piece of antler. Oh, I whittled it down to the size that they say is a long strip. I just steamed it over the kettle and stuck it in the coffee mug. And because antler is so hygroscopic, soaking it in milk or water for hours, it just doesn't do anything. Putting it in steam, it's amazing, because it just turns into this really pliable sort of, it's like your nail. It's like when you, you know, your nails go soft because it is a collagen type thing, yeah? So I just put it in my coffee cup, and I took it after 15 minutes, perfect form, went home, popped in two rivets, and then decorated it.
Brilliant.
And that came just by random, just bored on a Friday afternoon before I went home. And I've been reading, that was it, yeah? So, yeah, you do come across problems. And it is sometimes the most simplest ways that you just overlook. I can't believe all the literature. Yeah, we soaked it in milk for a week and we did this. It's like, why?
You know, when you look back in history and prehistory, it's this kind of creativity comes from, you know, accidental sources all the time. You know, curiosity breeds all kinds of crazy solutions and innovations.
Yeah.
That we laugh about things that we find out this way now, but heck, you know, that's where 90% of our technology came from.
It is from, yeah, it is. Will that hurt me if I do that? Yes. Oh, I knew that.
I'm going to cut in here with the final question of the day. Thank you so much for the interesting discussion so far. So the final question before we open this up for our listeners, what are your plans for the future? Or is there anything exciting going on now? Teresa, this is a perfect example here of how to plug your upcoming book that I know you've been working on. And also, how can the XArt community help to make a difference in regards to the points that you discussed today, do you think?
Well, let's see. Exciting things that are upcoming. I guess the obvious one here is that, yes, I have a book. It is the culmination of my PhD that's now being published. It's Redstone Press. And it is worth saying here that this is not a how-to manual on tanning. It is a book that has to do with how do we identify different tannage technologies of leather that still exists, so extant archaeological finds that are leather based. So don't get too excited that this is going to be a, you know, the end all book on how you tan skins. Set up for that. However, it does have one chapter that gives you some pretty good run throughs of most of the tannage technology. It has a little bit of something for everyone. In addition to that, yes, I've just gotten a website put up now, which is, that's always great. So lisaemmerich.com. Exactly that exciting, but there you are. Just kind of running through what I offer as far as museum analysis, open air demonstrations, and practical hands-on courses. As far as XArc members could take away from some of the points we talked about today, I think really just focusing on getting good information, making sure that that information is factual, that it's backed up by good research, and communicating that effectively in these sort of situations. If you're one of those people that this is something that you do, you know, you go out and talk about the past with the general public, making sure that you're telling them the most accurate knowledge to the best of your ability, the best of your ability to do that kind of research. That's important.
Or what we've got coming up, I suppose, exciting. We're bringing in and developing some experimental and some experiential modules within undergraduate and PGT schemes. I'm quite excited about that. We're actually going down the official line. I've been writing up a lot of stuff, and I know Roland, it'd be good to hear this. I've got some of the antler cone work that I've published with Neil Sharples, and I'm editing that to publish on XArt with some of the research and techniques and tools that I've come across for people to look at for making antler combs, and also on working and making the ores that are used. So there's a few bits and pieces coming through on that side. But one of my main focus at the moment, and it's not experimental or experiential, but it's just archaeology and excavations within in Germany that I'm doing on some Iron Age stuff. There I'm actually finding new forms and types of pottery. It's very interesting, and I've spoken to a few potters, and they don't really know how it's made with this certain what we call a saggy slip. So I'm already working on another experiment with a student to start looking at this type of pot. And I've spoke to several potters within that I know in Cardiff, and they're like, we have no idea how you're doing that slip. We'll have to work with you on this. So I really don't see straight away you've got the people involved. So that's another one quite excited and looking forward to doing. I just fill my life up with work. I don't know why, but it's fun. As to the final part, I agree mainly with what Teresa said. The community needs to carry on doing what they're doing. Every year, XArt just grows stronger and more robust with people coming in with really good experiments, with good testing, and so you can see the skill sets and the skill bases of people involved in XArt, and also the range of people that are now coming into XArt. I think the community is expanding and it's getting stronger, and I think it's going to go really well. And I think more and more people listen to these, and I'm plugging my students to join as well. So yeah, and once they do get and know about XArt, great. And I think the community is only going to get stronger and stronger as this goes on.
I'm afraid I couldn't hear much after you said saggy slip, but I will attempt to finish that.
Yeah, it's a new type of pottery with a saggy slip on it that runs down. It's really weird. It's called the Rautware. And but nobody, and I said, I've spoke to a load of potters or many potters and in Germany and mainly in Cardiff as well. And they don't really know how they've done this. It's if your pottery is melted and then set. So it's really quite, and these vessels are really large. They're up to 50 centimeters wide and 50 centimeters, 60 centimeters high. They're not small vessels. So I'm moving on to another experiment using my students and bringing them on. Okay. Yeah. Did you get about the community bit?
Yes. No, that was great. And so, sorry, I just wanted to add that in case anyone who's listening today has any ideas about the saggy slip, please do contact us after.
Oh, yeah, by all means. Yeah. I can, if they want, I can send them photographs and information on the pottery and where it's from and the period. But yeah, it's one of these vessels that seems to be quite occurring, and we don't know really how it's made or what it's really used for. So any help would be grateful. Gratefully accepted and acknowledged.
I think is exactly what this kind of thing is so wonderful for, is getting that kind of help. I think that's great.
Yeah, you plug your book and I'm going to plug How Can I Make This Pop?
Absolutely. Perfect. Sounds wonderful.
So Ian and Teresa, perhaps then you might just mention a little bit your involvement with Exarch and your plans for the future and what Exarch can do for you to help in these plans. And maybe Ian, you want to start?
So I started doing some experimental archaeology. I come across the British UK experimental archaeology site, and there I met Roland. Roland introduced me to Exarch, and from then it hasn't really stopped. Roland got me involved with my students, went over to Ullinghausen to work on and get involved in how an open-air museum in Europe is run, and the ins, the outs, the ups and downs, which again was really good. And I'm going to carry on using Exarch, obviously. I think the community is great. It's a large community. It's an expanding community. And the more and more chats like these we have, and hopefully back to conferences, we can bring more and more people through. I will be continuing my work with experimentation on antler and bone and stuff as soon as a window appears from the COVID. And then we can move on, carry on expanding.
Very similarly, I came across Exarch when I was part of the OpenArch project via the University of Exeter. And it just provides some fantastic networking opportunities. Anytime I need to get a hold of a museum, I just contact Exarch and I can put in contact with the people there that I need to be put in contact with. In addition to that, the wonderful conferences that they put on are just a fantastic platform for getting research, especially very targeted research, out to a group of interested individuals, which is something that's more difficult to do perhaps in our field since it is a bit niche. Yeah, that's basically what I've been using Exarch for, and I think it's a fantastic organization, and I certainly plan to continue as a member for as long as possible.
Actually, you mentioned the conferences just then. I think that the next conference will be on your new home turf, shall we say, in Exeter?
Yes, that is the plan in 2021. Exarch Conference, the Experimental Archaeology Conference, will be hosted at the University of Exeter.
So if anyone's interested in hearing more about these kind of things, very welcome to join Exarch and come and have a look in the conference. So we already have a couple of questions. One question from David Woodcraft is for both of you, although maybe especially for Ian, do you ever experience situations where you wanted to craft one thing or replicate one thing and it led to several other projects? For example, because you first had to make a specialized tool and that involved using a different material or something like that.
Absolutely. I have to agree with that. That is so true. You start something, you start to make a tool, as you said, to do stuff, and you end up opening a whole Pandora's box of other skill sets or other materials or other tools that you need or you think you might need. So you get distracted. And sometimes it's a good distraction, but also not so good because it takes you away from what you're primarily doing. In the end, you realize if you don't do that, you can't actually do what you're trying to experiment with or how you're trying to make a tool or something from the material using the tool. So, yeah, it does. But that's the fun of it. That's the part of it. That's the bit which is also opening up your skill sets all the time. And if you don't come across that, then maybe you're stuck in a sort of a blind alley or something. But looking to the sides and being distracted, to me, is a natural progression to expanding your skill sets.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think as I've come forward in my understanding of my technology, all of the skin working, one of the things you find is that as you walk that technology backward through time, instead of, you know, the fairly modern tools that I use just to produce skins, you know, nothing to do with experimental work, but more to do with your craft, and going backward in time and needing to produce tools that are now made out of bone, made out of stone, made out of wood, these really do expand into little sidelines, you know, looking at useware on bone tools, looking at useware on stone tools, and what tools were used to produce the tools that you now need for tanning. And it can become quite an expansive field quite quickly.
A never-ending rabbit hole, basically. Worse than YouTube, some might say. We have actually quite an interesting question here from Diana Iapova. I think she mentioned in her meet and greet that she's quite new to the field of experimental archaeology, and she has a very simple question, but probably quite a complex answer. How do you find a hypothesis to be tested through experimental archaeology?
Well, I guess coming up with your hypothesis, coming up with your question, I think if I understand the question correctly, you're asking, how does one actually come up with a question?
Exactly, yes. Which I guess, I mean, for us, we're, you know, experimental archaeologists, it's quite second nature. But for those who are just starting, what sort of advice would you offer?
Oftentimes, for myself anyway, you go back to the archaeological record and you find, for example, a tool, there's three or four different proposed uses for. And your question can be as simple as, which use is going to be the best supported one? So you would then remake that tool using period-appropriate technology, so all of your manufacturing marks, striations and things would match the archaeological record. You use three or four of these tools on, you know, each tool on a different medium, say skin, bone, wood, whatever it is. And then you take those tools and you analyze them either just by visual analysis or microscopic analysis. And then you would compare things like those use wear striations back to the archaeological original. And whichever one matches best is the one most likely to be your answer.
I do agree. Reading was one of the first things that got me hooked into looking at experimental or experiential archaeology as well. Not only just the reading, fortunately, as I've said, I was an illustrator, so I had hands-on to various amounts of artifacts of different types and materials. And it was my observations from the illustration that led me to the library to look up academic research and resources that have been wrote about certain objects. And then you start to follow on. If you read it and analyze it, you'll spot little gaps that you can see where you can start to ask questions and put new information forward and bring it to the forefront.
Yeah, perfect. And so I think also Diana and any other sort of starting experimental archaeologists who are listening today, definitely get in touch with us at Exarch. We can put you in contact with anyone who can help you, just give you a bit of a head start. So we have a lot of expertise here for you to use. Our next question is from Julia. So this is for both of you. What are the most frustrating crafting generalizations or simplifications, underestimations that you see commonly given about your different specialist craft areas? Are these sort of generalizations pervaded more by public perceptions or actually by academics without the same sort of practical experimental experience that you identify as such an important part of these material studies?
This is a good question. Yes, that's fun. For me, at least, I guess there's two notable ones that I get all the time. One is chewing skins. It's just something that is absolutely embedded in the brain of the general public. You see it repeated as well in academic papers. It's not to say that someone could not chew a hide soft. However, when you're talking about groups who need 30 to 40 skins per year, just for three or four people, it is an incredibly inefficient, number one, way to soften a skin. And two, it's just physiologically impossible. You would have no teeth by the time you were 20. It's a ridiculous concept. And then the second one, the fact that early peoples ran around wearing rawhide. Rawhide is a really specialist product. It's hard. It has not been worked soft in any way, shape, or form. And where it's a very useful utilitarian product, incredibly useful, it's not a clothing product, except for perhaps shoes, and you can get away with hats and things like that out of it. Doesn't withstand any sort of environmental issues very well if you can't really get it wet and dry and wet and dry. And that's another one. And you don't hear it from the general public so much, but you do read it in academic discourse quite a lot. And it harkens back to some terminology confusion between commercial terminology for what counts as leather and what doesn't. So it's things like this that pop up over and over that you feel like you do spend a lot of time sort of banging your head against a wall trying to change the general perception. You have put forward a more accurate understanding of the past.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I must have to say, do run into, say, more reading in academia rather than general working with the public, where you get examples of, oh, and this crass person just knocks it out and does that, if you see what I mean. And there's no real thought behind how some of these objects and skills from the past and right through I don't know if they just don't understand processes of how these skills take years and years to develop. It's not something you go, oh, learn that overnight, no problem. See what I mean? Yeah. So you have to allow for people learning and for what the skills are within the subject. other than just sometimes to say, you know, for example, oh, you just draw objects. It's like, no, you know, there are examples right through, doesn't mean within experimental or experiential, but right through other areas where, you know, generalizations are made. And yeah, I do think I get more from reading in academia than I do from the general public. The general public seems to be more inquisitive, and they really, you know, get down to asking a lot of good, interesting questions. And they really seem interested in what we're doing as well.
Actually, related to that, there's this excellent question from Louise Mumford. I'm saying, when working with the public, you always get something back, either really useful insights from craftspeople who happen to turn up, or else incredible stories from the past that is sparked by your work. And she mentions Teresa's story about St. Fagan's, about the World War II rabbit skin rug, is something that you might remember. And she asks then, what are the most useful technological insights that you've had this way? Or what are your favorite stories that have been inspired by people seeing you work when working with the public?
Don't actually remember the rabbit skin rug, unfortunately. That sounds fantastic. I'll have to question her about that again afterward. Insights, probably it would be time that somebody explained to me that one of her great-grandmothers used to, well, brain tan, fat tan, so North American variation on fat tanning, and she would lay the white brain tan skins out in the sun. This would have been in the desert southwest, so hot, bright sun. And she said that grandmother felt that she did not have to smoke these skins afterward, and they had a increased ability to be wetted and then softened without a heavy resoftening period being involved. And after hearing this, between that information and my chemistry background, I was able to go, oh my goodness, UV will actually help with the oxidation of oils. I'm wondering if could UV a factor in producing a white fat tan, an unsmoked fat tan that has improved re-wetting qualities? And yes, the answer is yes, it can. It was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds great. Do you have any nice stories, Ian?
Most of my stories, as you say, when you're meeting or you're working with people, whether it be outreach or within archaeology, or even just, I don't know, just generally meeting people as you do stuff in the countryside a lot when I was younger and during archaeology, is that you meet various people with some fantastic old skills, and they sort of come up to you and say, oh, you know, if you hold this tool this way, you'll find that it does this. And sometimes it's just it's so obvious, and you just can't see it for the wood for the trees. And rotating a certain tool, I can't remember if it was a certain chisel I was using, I could actually create a smoother effect and a quicker finish on a piece of bone or antler, and using what we would see as conventional. And it's little skills and little, Teresa was saying, you know, things that you don't think about, they come in from a different direction. You can, you know, you ask them. I mean, I got one that's not related, but I remember when I first learned to skin a pheasant, and it was because I'd done a roadkill, and one of the guys on the archaeological site, farm workers, oh, you don't want to be doing that. He said, you want to skin it. And I'd never come across skinning a pheasant. I'd never thought about it before, because obviously, you know, you use cooking with it on. Oh my God, it was brilliant. And this was some 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I first learned that skill. So yeah, it's one of my funniest. It was quite good. But these are all essential skills and little traits that people need to pass on. And I think that working with people that come around to see us what we do, and also, as I said, the reenactors, when we can work with those as well, because I'll put a lot of tools to the ultimate test and take them from one end of the scale to the other. So yeah, I really do think that, yeah, it is impressive how we can learn different skills.
That also relates to what you were both saying earlier as well about the need to kind of incorporate that specialist knowledge, and also what you were saying about that there's actually more generalizations and simplifications made by academics without practical experience than there are from public people. So yeah, definitely an interesting aspect of it. Caroline has a question for both of you. So again, a lot of about interaction with the general public. Have you noticed any surprising ways that men versus women behave in your sort of workshops or teaching sessions or demonstrations? How about, for example, younger people versus older people, or any sort of different demographic variation?
I've noticed, I've done some outreach work. We had projects, and I was working with some colleagues in Cardiff called, as I mentioned, Men in Sheds. And it was there doing that project that I did come across working with older members of the public in a sort of it was probably a very male orientated environment to start with. They were really quite dismissive of the antler working that we were doing, whether we were creating rings or some, or you know, fine pendants or some how to make combs. They saw it as girls' work and ladies' jewelry, but they didn't really see it for what it was. the use of a material that has now gone out of fashion, but it's coming back in, and it's very durable and very sustainable. But that quickly changed. After we worked with them for a couple of months, they realized, and it changed. And the outreach side, when you read with the general public, I've been working with Jackie and others out, and I don't seem to notice much of a difference in the demographic. I think once you're at these big festivals or meetings that you're at, everyone seems to get engaged because I think everyone feeds off each other. So I haven't really noticed it much in the outreach. Maybe Teresa's seen something different.
With the skin working, there does seem to be a perception to some degree that this is men's work. And when you do get into the industrialized time periods with leather working, it does change into a guild craft, and it was fairly male dominated. But prior to that, everybody knew how to tan skin. And aside from being, it could very well have been women's work. We can't really say that about deep history. We can't say, yes, one gender did this and another gender did that. It's just not a question that we can very easily answer. Whether do you have women come into courses thinking that, you know, it's going to be incredibly hard work and that they're barely going to be physically capable of doing it? I think it's a nice realization when they get there that, yes, they can. It's really no problem. Yes, it's hard work, but they're certainly capable of it. I've had a 10-year-old brain tan a deer skin and turn out a beautiful end product. Part of taking a course is you learn tips and tricks that make it not just brute force, but an actual art and craft. And then I guess a demographic between age groups, my experience has always been with children, actually. You know, adults come in and I'm doing a deer processing demonstration, and most of the time it's a roadkill, so they're not always the most visually appealing thing on the face of the planet, legs sticking out at weird angles and whatnot. But adults' first response is, that's cool, but you. Let's go, you, but at the same time, they're saying you, they've already got their hands inside of it. It's just the social response that they've been taught. They don't really feel it. They want to get their hands in there and learn what you're demonstrating. And I think that's really fantastic. I actually not really a huge kid person, but it is quite fun, those kinds of demonstrations, to have them just pop up and help. It's fun.
Thanks. I have another question slightly related from Roland. Do you notice it, sort of the public and the questions in one area of the world, both of you have worked in different regions, are different from one another? So, you know, would maybe people in Germany be interested in one thing, but people in the US would be more interested in another thing?
Yes, there is a difference there in my experience. In places where fur is something that's already used consistently within the society, I don't have the same ethics discussions about the use of primary animal products, as you know, most of the things that I do require the animal to die in order to provide them. So when I'm in a lot of the European countries, that is a discussion that I have, and I have quite frequently. As long as it stays a discussion, I am more than happy to have that talk. I think that's really fascinating. However, that's places where hunting is very normal and a part of the things that people do as a day-to-day life skill. That question isn't important, I guess, to people. It's just not the first question on their mind.
Yeah, I've worked a lot in Germany doing sort of, you know, just archaeology and sort of bits of outreach, which we're now employing as part of our excavations. And yeah, people in Germany do have a slightly different view when we're showing them bits and pieces that we're doing, or tools, or with animals. They have a different sort of way of like, yeah, you hunt a boar, you hunt a deer, it's fine. You can go out and shoot them, it's fine. There's shooting pitches everywhere across the countryside. It seems to be a very social thing. While I found in Britain, it's a little bit different. Obviously, deer hunting is quite revered and costs a lot. You just can't pop out with your gun and go and shoot stuff. So yeah, they do have a different outlook on the ethical side and the animal side. But with the tools and the techniques that we use, I found they're generally the same. People use a tool in a certain way, and that seems to be quite universal. There may be some tweaks and there may be some amendments to the tool, and it has different forms. Generally, we're all on the same side on that. Certain tools do certain things, and you do use them in certain ways. So I found that quite a leveling. It's quite good to know that.
Now we've got into the sort of discussion about ethical use of material, because obviously, Ian, you were saying you use antler quite a lot. That can be naturally shed, so it doesn't involve killing anything. But with bone, you would assume that an animal does have to die, and obviously using the leather as well, like you said, Teresa, that does have to happen. Especially in sort of, I don't know, in modern society, veganism, vegetarianism is such a big thing. Is that a problem? Is that an issue when you're doing your public outreach? How does that affect your discussions with the public?
I wouldn't say it's a problem, but it is a discussion that is often something over the course of the summer. I think I have the ethics discussion probably about 100 times a week And it's one of those things that I can say that, you know, all of my animals, all of the skins, all of the parts that I'm using, you know, they come from places with sustainable harvesting strategies, from healthy populations, in places where hunting and trapping seasons are very well controlled, and have an emphasis on main methods of. So as long as we can keep it as a discussion and you don't have someone who's really vehemently there to start an argument, then it can be very productive. And it is an important discussion, in my opinion, at least, to have.
Obviously, Teresa, you run into probably more heavy discussions because obviously the killing and the skinning of the animal. What I find, obviously, when we're working outside with deer antler, you'd be surprised how many people assume that we've had that animal killed or it's been shot. And you do have to spend a large portion of each day chatting to people about how antler is shed and how it's shed once a year and the renewable resource that it is. And you know, you don't need to kill these animals. You know, I said, yes, sometimes they are because, you know, people need to eat or they're going to need skins and the bones, which we've said and I've shown and Teresa have shown, you can use the bones for all sorts. We try not to waste anything from that animal when we have it, use it and we process it. So the ethical debates are quite interesting, but I haven't really had anything what I would say was angry or in your face. Everyone is really quite open to listening to what people say and what their views are. And a lot of people go away quite enlightened and not knowing antler and the way it sheds, and we don't harm Bambi and his boys. So it's quite nice.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We have a question from Rosario about bone use. So she says that she finds that it takes about 6 months of curing bones in their skin for best use, but she can't sort of find any articles for this. When she scrapes hides, then she finds that scraping keeps the scraping bones well supple and well oiled. She was wondering if either of you can recommend any sort of studies that have been done or any tips on preparing bones from butchering the animal to the point of being able to use them in terms of sort of keeping them usable, if that makes sense.
Maybe Ian, you can suggest some papers on this. I'm not actually aware of any studies off the top of my head that relate to this.
I was just trying to think of myself off the top of my head what studies are out there to show for bone preparation. A lot of the time when I'm working with bone, I split a sheep metatarsal or a sheep bone to get and make an awl from it. I don't really prepare a lot, especially with antler. Antler needs very little preparation. You can use it straight from when it's been shed and you cut it up and start working it. I've also found like with bone handles that I've used or made deer, again, once you've sort of cured them and defleshed them, remove the marrow from the inside, I can use them quickly. I don't know much of you say of the 6 month preparation. It'd be really interesting to see how the bone is affected and the finishes that you can get and the workability of it as well. But off the top of my head, no, I can't think of anything that I could say. I've read stuff by McGregor on antler preparation and stuff like that, but not specifically bone.
Correct. Yeah, I've not read almost anything on bone. And for myself, my bone tools, because when I do bone tool use, usually very expedient. I need to tan a skin, therefore I'm making my tool right there. I use almost exclusively fresh bone. If I am going to be processing my bone, I tend to scrape off the membrane layer on the outside of the bone and then I just simmer it very lightly for perhaps 15 minutes and I cut it apart and use it. The only thing that I have run into is that over time, yes, bone does age and it loses its organic component. You lose that organic component, you're left with only the mineral parts, and they do not hold up, of course. So using bone that's too old, obviously you end up with just powder. All of my skin working tools, as she mentioned, they are greased all the time simply by using them on a skin. And I'm careful, I definitely wash my tools, but I don't wash them with anything particularly severe. I try and stay away from dish soap and that kind of thing, because I don't want to strip the oils out of them completely. But take a little bit out from greasy creatures if you're going to be using pig or sheep or something like that. They're very, very greasy and they're pretty unpleasant to work with unless you strip a little bit of that grease out. But as a general rule, I'm mostly using things in the cervid family. So moose, elk in Europe, deer, and occasionally I've made things like awls and needles from smaller animals like fox. And bird bones, of course, make fantastic needles as well.
I think also if anyone has, I'm sure we can try and find a nice bibliography for you, Rosario, if you want to get in touch with Exarch or with Ian, maybe if they come up with any ideas, also post them here.
Absolutely, sure.
So we do have one more question, and then I also have some questions to finish off for today. It's a question from Lugiri. So you both practice various crafts, both for academic and public outreach purposes. Have you ever been interested in the market of early crafts? So have you personally created and sold objects? Is this sort of a lucrative business to get into, or are people interested in traditional handmade crafts or reproductions?
That's quite a good question. Yeah, because obviously I've been asked to make antler combs for people. Yeah, they see the combs, they like the combs, and you do make them and you do get paid, you know, a bit of cash here or in favours or exchange, if you see what I mean, trade in the old ways. Yeah. What you do run into is obviously you've got a job, and to do it as a full-time job and the work that's actually involved in making something by hand, I don't think people these days want to pay for it. Yeah, you can say that I've made this item, it took me 4 days. What would you charge that? If you charge the proper hourly rate for that skilled person, it would just become, you know, non-affordable, if you see what I mean, yeah? Unless you can find some way of mass production, but then you're losing that individual element that somebody's crafted it for you with a unique touch and very bespoke, if you see what I mean, yeah? So you know, I do get torn, and I do commissions of cones if people do get in touch. I usually say to them, okay, that's fine, but you'll get it when I get some time. So, you know, and people have waited 6 months and then I just, oh yeah, I've got time now, I'll knock it out. Yeah. So I think if you're going to seriously go into a trade or manufacturing or as a company or just do as an individual craftsperson, it's going to take a lot of work and you'll have to create a lot of stock blanks and the things that you require to make it affordable in the day and age that we live in. Not to say that it's not a fantastic thing to do and it might be a sideline while you do something else at the same time, but I would find it difficult to actually make a living out of it for making antler objects and bone objects or stone. Yeah, so you'd have to be something else involved as well.
Absolutely couldn't agree more. I do have a background in selling brain tan skins when I still lived in the US. So you can tell by my accent at this point that I'm not British originally. But then I produce replicas for museums, but those are very specialist pieces where they are willing to pay for the time and effort that goes into producing something in the way that it would have been produced prehistorically. The only thing I do is a sideline that is of a commercial nature. I do custom clothing using all traditional technologies. However, obviously when I produce that, I'm using metal needles, I'm using scissors, I'm using metal tools to actually tan the skins. It's someone very specifically requests something and is willing to pay for the extra time involved in doing it in a period appropriate way. And it's simply not financially viable for most people to purchase something like that. And those people are very few and far between. I've run into two in my life. So it's not something that I would go into from that end as a living, no.
I actually also have my own experience of this because I had a small business for a while talking about selling antler rings and bone jewelry and all sorts of things. And you may hear that I said I had a business because it wasn't exactly that viable. It was great fun. It was amazing. But yeah, like Ian was saying, being able to price your pieces to cover the actual amount of work that went in was very difficult. So if I can add in my little bit there, I would say make sure that you don't undersell yourself if you're doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so we have time for one more question from Sashad for Teresa. When you accidentally pierce a skin during preparation, how do you prevent the damage getting larger?
So, a couple of things. There's holes are different. So, bullet hole, the entrance wound, because when the bullet goes in, it's hot. Edges of that hole on the entry side are actually cauterized. It will not tear out unless you actually run your tool over it when you're defleshing or degraining, depending on the type of tanning you're doing. So don't worry about those unless it's an aesthetic issue. Exit wounds don't have the same deal and they tend to be bigger. So anything whilst you're cleaning the skin, so while you're defleshing it over a beam or in a frame, if you put a hole in the skin, what you need to do is not drag your tool over it again. It's as simple as that. Don't make it larger by applying force to it. Now, after you're done with the cleaning and after you're done with the dressing, and it's just a simple matter of sewing it up before you go to the softening stage. For vegetable tan, I tend to sew up the holes before they go into the vegetable tan solution, bark tanning, if you're more familiar with that term. And then, again, be careful with vegetable tan when you're softening. It has a much higher tendency to tear than your fat tans do. Fat tans, if you just sew the hole up and then are careful around it when you're pulling it over a table or over a staking post during the softening process, you'll be just fine. It won't enlarge any further. There is one little extra caveat on that. Not use leather needles to sew up the holes in your skin. And by a leather needle, I mean the triangular cross-section ones that have sharp edges on them. It actually cuts the fibers of the skin, and each hole that you make with that needle whilst you're sewing the skin up, will in itself get bigger and bigger. So you really want to use, you can have a pointy needle, that's no problem, but you want one that's round and cross-section wedge.
So I hope that helped, Sajjad. Thank you for that, Teresa. I'm really sorry, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So thank you very much to Ian and to Teresa for joining us today, sharing your experience and your expertise. I think that we all learned a lot of different tips and advice given. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Exarch Show. This show is produced by Exarch, which is a non-profit, membership-supported organization. To join us or support us, visit us online at exarch.net.